headlines, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says enemies have been seeking to advance their malicious political agenda by waging an economic war against the Iranian nation. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams the Israeli president's trip to the UAE, saying the visit emboldens the regime to commit more crimes against Palestinians. And Canadians rally in Ottawa against mandatory COVID vaccination. Reports say Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his family have been moved to a secure location. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Iran's leader says enemies have been seeking to advance their political plots against the country through an economic war. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said an economic collapse was a prelude to wicked political goals. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, enemies sought to pit the Iranian nation against the Islamic establishment. The leader cited an example of economic enterprises that have not tied their operations to the removal of sanctions, adding that Iran's economy should not be contingent on issues over which officials have no control. The leader made the remarks during an address to a group of Iranian manufacturers. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Mustafa Khoshcheshm, journalist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Tehran. Thank you very much, Mr. Khoshcheshm. Now, it was quite interesting, the leader's remarks, and of course pointing out that no one should actually tie their hopes to something that is uncertain, which is the negotiations.
Hello, Monsieur, and thanks for having me. Well, true. This economic warfare or the sanctions policy is part of the United States carrot and stick, which came into practice within the containment strategy over a decade ago. And alongside, Richard Nephew was known to be the architect of the sanctions at the U.S. administration. Kenneth Katzman led the sanctions group at the Congress, and I remember quite well that over a decade ago, when post-election riots in 2009 happened, and after several months, rioters disappeared almost from the streets. Kenneth Katzman ran an interview with, Times Magazine or New York Times, where he said that we are imposing the sanctions in order to wear off the public support of the Islamic Republic so that these people who take out to the streets on February 11 rallies or marking the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution victory or the Quds Day rallies, they are from the lower classes of the society, so these sanctions could dissuade them from supporting the Islamic Republic and turn them against the establishment, hopefully. And we do that, he said at that time, in order to reinvigorate the rioters, the numbers in the streets, and then they started this kind of warfare against the Islamic Republic, but not to topple the Islamic Republic because they knew it, and this sanctions policy came into practice for the containment strategy. So the next step was, forcing Iran into talks that we all experienced under the JCPOA. This was not hidden to the Iranian supreme leader and establishment. I remember quite well when President Rouhani was very much hopeful about the talks and he intended to start the talks. He was advised by the Iranian leader repeatedly that, okay, you could go ahead to do the talks, but you need to have a parallel plan B that's working on Iranian economy in order to decrease the efficiency of the sanctions, because it's a weapon of the United States and you need to decrease its efficiency in order to dissuade the U.S. from using this kind of weapon against the Iranians. So that's government failed to, keep the parallel, the balance between these two. But now that it's been proved to the Iranians that they need to rely on their domestic economy and they voted for President Raisi to do the same, now Iran has the instruments. And I believe that in the first few months of this administration, Iran has done quite well in order to make sure that the peak of the sanctions efficiency is gone. That's why probably the Iranian leader spoke about this now and not a few months ago. because now we rest assured that we could do a lot. Right, let's remember that despite the allegations made by the U.S. and Israeli experts and officials, this is not the Biden administration that has gone soft on Iran or the sanctions on Iran and purchase of oil by foreign, you know, countries and firms. On the contrary, they've done their best that three of their top diplomats, like Nicholas Burns, now the ambassador to China, as well as Wendy Sherman and William Burns, to China to dissuade China from buying crude from Iran a few months before the start of the negotiations with Iran. And they did their best in order to freeze, to keep Iranian frozen assets abroad, but they failed. Now Iran is developing a lot of foreign trade with Russia, China. Iran's crude sales have been on increase despite the U.S. opposition. Iran is doing business with Latin America growingly, and even the UAE, that's working hard with the U.S. and it's an agent or proxy of the U.S. in this region, they sent delegations to Iran in order to expand economic cooperation with Iran, despite the fact that the U.S. requested them and warned them to stop doing so unless the JCPOA is back into life. But
well, it seems that we've lost Mr. Khoshish. We'll be talking to him shortly again. Moving on. Tehran and Moscow are moving toward a financial alliance with an Iranian lawmaker, saying that the two sides will be ditching the U.S. dollar from their trade transactions. Ebrahim Rezai, who chairs the Iran-Russia Parliamentary Friendship Group, says the two sides have agreed to move towards de-dollarization and breaking the monopoly of the U.S. currency and trade deals. The two sides have also reached agreements in energy, monetary, banking, and transportation areas during discussions that took place when Iranian president visited Moscow earlier this month. According to the legislator, the two countries have agreed to use marine transportation to facilitate trade. They're also planning to exchange their agricultural produce. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams the ongoing official trip by Israeli president to the United Arab Emirates. Hamas says the visit takes place amid continued Israeli crimes against Palestinians. It says that such visits embolden the regime to commit more crimes and violate Palestinians' rights. The movement also says normalization with Israel only serves the Zionist interests in the region. The Israeli president arrived in Abu Dhabi on Sunday morning for a two-day visit. He is the first Israeli president to visit the UAE. The Sheikh, along with Bahrain, established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago under U.S. brokered deals. Palestinians see the normalization as a betrayal of their cause. Israeli media say their president will use the UAE visit to encourage more Persian Gulf Arab nations to normalize with Tel Aviv. Now, Israeli president is in the United Arab Emirates for talks with leaders of that country. Greeting the president in Abu Dhabi, UAE foreign minister has hailed this visit actually as one of the huge steps towards a successful relationship. Now, this is the first time an Israeli president is visiting the Sheikh. He will be meeting with top Emirati officials, including the Crown Prince and the UAE, as we said to you before, along with Bahrain, established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago in U.S. brokered deals. Palestinians see this as a betrayal of their cause. New reports coming out of the United States has transferred hundreds of Daesh terrorists from a prison in northeast Syria to a location in the east. That reportedly happened after the terror group attacked the prison last week. We discussed those developments in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
New reports emerging of the U.S. role in northeastern Syria. American forces have transferred 750 Daesh terrorists, most of them foreigners, from a prison in Hasaka province. Russian media are quoting special sources as saying that the detainees have been transferred to a desert in Deir al-Zor province. They say U.S. coalition drones perform monitoring operations to secure their exit routes until they arrived at their destination near the town of Bukama. Sources say the transfer process took place in batches by SUVs and buses. A number of top Daesh leaders holding Arab, Belgian, and Dutch nationalities were among the escapees. Last week, Daesh attacked the detention center. Heavy fighting then ensued. Kurdish-led forces, who are allies of the U.S., are fighting the Syrian government, and they are running the prison. Syria's UN envoy has blamed Washington for the clashes. Bassam Sabak says that the U.S. is seeking to recycle Daesh and justify American military presence in Syria. Now, to get some insight into that story, let me invite a couple of guests. We'll have our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joining us. Also, Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, is joining us out of Sydney. Let's first go to Damascus. Mohammed, give us some more information and what we hear in news reports regarding this transfer of Daesh forces by U.S.
Yes, Russian media reported that the United States transported 750 Daesh terrorists from Hasake to the countryside of Deir ez-Zor, mainly around Abu Kamal on the borderline between Syria and Iraq, and to area near Al-Bishri Mountain, also in Deir ez-Zor's southern countryside. Now, according to reports, even the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, which works with the United States over there, forces on the ground in Al-Hasake, retreated from three positions around the Ghoiran prison, which Daesh attacked a week ago, and allowed terrorists to escape from that, from those three positions towards two areas in Al-Hasake where they gathered. Then the SDF helped them to get out and reach those areas in Deir ez-Zor countryside. According to those reports by Russian media, also the U.S.-led coalition reconnaissance drones helped those Daesh terrorists and directed them to use special routes over there in that desert of Deir ez-Zor to reach those areas. Now, this is definitely not the first time that cooperation between Daesh and the United States in that area of Syria is reported. Russia said it many times that even the United States is training directly those terrorists of Daesh in its illegal base of Al-Tanf on the borderline between Syria and Iraq. And also the Syrian government, always officials note to that support of the United States to Daesh. And it says always that the United States wants to help Daesh to keep control in some areas in order to use that as a pretext to stay occupying Syria.
Now we have a clear picture. Now let me ask Tim Anderson about what the U.S. is exactly is doing in Syria. We had that prison attack where, you know, Daesh inmates, some of them were able to flee, and then now we have the U.S. moving these terrorists. Maybe they call them good terrorists. I don't know. Every now and then, you know, definitions change. Good terrorists, bad terrorists, modern ones. So what's the U.S. exactly doing in Syria?
Well, Daesh has always been a creature of the U.S. to try and destabilize Syria and Iraq. It was created first in Iraq back in 2004, 2005, then exported to Syria in 2012. And there have been constant reports of U.S. direct collaboration with Daesh in Syria and Iraq from Syrian, Iraqi, and Iranian sources since 2014. Now, more recently, there were Syrian television reports of Daesh terrorists who were captured by the Syrians and confessed they'd come from the U.S. base in Al-Tanf to attack the Syrian army in Palmyra and the T4 air base. 3 months ago, there was a report of a number of Daesh families moved across to Iraq. So there are these constant reports, and the latest one, of course, is significant in that a large number of fighters have been moved down to the one border post in the border between Iraq and Syria, which is controlled by Iraq and Syria. So the U.S. has been launching missile attacks on that base for a long time, and also the bombing in Al-Baghouz was two years ago was linked to that too. So the latest thing is another step in a series of constant collaborations which the U.S. has tried to keep hidden, but clear direct collaborations with Daesh to try and keep destabilizing Syria and Iraq and to keep the two countries apart.
Okay, Tim, how can the U.S. say that? Because as you said, they were the ones who created groups like Daesh, and that's what Donald Trump alluded to, you know, Hillary Clinton and others during the Obama era. And then they launch the so-called war on terror. They fight what they call terrorists in some parts of the world, and then they go in in broad daylight, support them, and they're doing what they're doing now in Syria.
It's a larger scale of what's called a protection racket in U.S. terms. Basically, they demand that they be paid for protection, basically. And, of course, they're claiming their presence in Iraq and Syria to this day is to fight Daesh, when from the Syrian and Iraqi and Iranian sources, we know the relationship has been one of constant collaboration. So the problem is, of course, that in the propaganda war stakes, the U.S. media will never admit this. They never acknowledge this at all. Even when the massacre in Al-Baghouz was revealed by the New York Times some months ago, they claimed it was in the middle of the fog of war fighting ISIS in that same part of Syria that these 750 terrorists have now been sent to around the Al-Bukamal border crossing.
Okay, I appreciate your contribution. Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Sydney.
Social anger over mandatory COVID vaccination has now reached Canada, with thousands of people turning out in Ottawa to protest the mandates announced by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The march began as truckers protested against obligatory vaccination for entry into the U.S., but the city's residents later joined the convoy and marched on the parliament. The protest was held amid tight security triggered by violent rhetoric that promoters used on social media. There are reports that Trudeau and his family were moved to a secure location from their downtown Ottawa home. 77% of Canada's population has received two jabs. That includes 90% of truckers. Canada made vaccination mandatory for federal workers in October. A similar mandate was jointly announced with the U.S. for cross-border truckers last month. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In a victory for political freedom, a German federal court ruled that Munich's refusal of a public venue for a debate on the city's anti-BDS resolution was unconstitutional. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Audrey Neuhof Ryder. This article is published under the heading Munich Anti-BDS Policy is Illegal. German Federal Court Rules. Stay tuned for more. In a victory for political freedom, a German federal court ruled that Munich's refusal of a public venue for a debate on the city's anti-BDS resolution was unconstitutional. The city's policy violates the fundamental right to freedom of expression, the court ruled. The decision is a slap in the face for the Munich City Council, which adopted a resolution in 2017 barring public funding or space for supporters of BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign for Palestinian rights. The ruling has wide implications for free speech across Germany, where people face regular repression and smears from officials over their support for Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, in neighboring Austria, the Vienna city government is suing a member of BDS Austria for defamation over a Facebook post critical of the Zionist regime apartheid. In April 2018, resident Klaus Reid tried to book a room at the Munich City Museum to host a discussion about how the municipality's anti-BDS resolution would affect freedom of speech. The city refused the booking for what it considered a BDS-related event. Reid took the matter to court. At first, a lower court ruled against him, affirming that Munich had the right to impose such restrictions. He appealed, and in 2021, but Munich could not accept that and brought the case to federal court, hoping to overturn Reid's victory. The attempt failed, however. On January 20th, Germany's Federal Administrative Court in Leipzig issued its ruling siding with Reid. The federal court affirmed that German law guarantees everyone the right to freely express and disseminate their opinion. It found that the Munich city government was not allowed to violate that right by denying permission for an event because of the expected expression of opinions on the BDS campaign or on its content, goals, and topics. The federal court also affirmed that Munich's anti-BDS resolution is not a law. The landmark decision sends a warning to city councils across Germany that have passed similar resolutions and have been denying organizers of BDS-related events access to public venues. The ruling also has implications for the German parliament's 2019 anti-BDS resolution, which, although not legally binding, urges German institutions and public bodies to deny funding and facilities to groups that support the BDS movement. The city government in the Austrian capital Vienna is suing a representative of BDS Austria for an August 2021 post on the activist group's Facebook page. The post shows a photo of a municipal billboard with a protest poster pasted over it, but leaving the city's official logo still visible. The protest poster resembles the famous Visit Palestine poster from 1930s, but instead it bears the word Visit Apartheid. The protest poster also has the city's logo on it. One BDS Austria social media post had the sarcastic caption, "We are pleased that the city of Vienna also takes note of apartheid and publicly states it." In November, a member of BDS Austria was notified that the Vienna municipality filed a lawsuit alleging that the BDS movement incites hatred against Israeli people. Therefore, the city claims being publicly associated with BDS is defamation, since the designation of the situation in Palestine as apartheid constitutes damage to their reputation, they said. The city is asking the court to prohibit BDS Austria from making use of signs which belonged to the municipality, and $4,000 in damages. If the court orders BDS Austria to pay the legal costs, the total amount could be as high as $40,000. The European Legal Support Center, ELSC, a civil rights and legal advocacy group, is calling this an example of a SLAP, a strategic lawsuit against public participation. Such lawsuits are typically aimed at silencing critical speech. The city's claim is patently ridiculous because it is apparent that the poster was roughly pasted over the city's billboard and is not an official message of Vienna City. Moreover, Vienna's denial of the reality of apartheid experienced by Palestinians flies in the face of a growing consensus, affirmed even by such mainstream groups as Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem. ELSC has set up a crowdfunding campaign to ask for public donations to help with legal expenses, and a petition supporting BDS Austria has gathered almost 700 signatures.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi
wa barakatuh.
An old question, and so many new answers are given to that, especially in today's world, with these so-called broad-minded intellectuals within the religion of Islam and out of that, Quran, is it the word of Allah or Muhammad? Okay, let's start with Sayyid Mohsen.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, definitely this is the word of Allah. It is not the word of any man. And okay. Within the Quran, we have the verses that prove this.
Okay.
And even...
What's the verse?
About the words of Allah, obviously, it is said about the Prophet, mm-hmm. that وَمَا يَنْتَقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَىٰ.
Okay.
That's the first thing. The second thing is, obviously, Quran is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And obviously, if it was from anyone else, mm-hmm. or the things that you see, if there were two of them, you would see corruption in it. Obviously, two people cannot manage one thing. So there are many other verses as well, like in regards to this. And obviously, when we say this is the word of Allah, we need to prove why it is the words of Allah, not word of a man or a person. Number one, the first thing is that the Prophet himself has said that this is not from me, this is from Allah. Obviously, he had some narrations, we have some traditions from the Prophet, and there's some of the parts of his speeches are the parts of the Quran. And he himself at that time has mentioned that these are the wordings of Allah, this is the part of the Quran. And the things which he has said as a tradition, he did not give any explanation about it. Mm-hmm. So this is the first thing when we look at the history, okay. to know about it.
Yes.
But there are other proofs. Obviously, there are many questions that how you prove, what is the role of miracle here? Can we
yes.
believe in these things and all those things? So
Archangel
this
Gabriel.
Obviously, these
yeah.
are the lengthy, we can say.
You know,
can I give a quick answer to that?
Okay, okay, okay.
It's a very simple answer, actually. During the time of the Prophet, who was he brought to who the Quran was brought forward to?
Mm-hmm.
It was brought to Arabs.
Okay.
Which Arabs? The Arabs that were known for their poetry and their eloquence and their high sophisticated Arabic language.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran is challenging the Arabs to bring verses like the Holy Quran,
yes.
why would they go into war to fight Islam? Bring up verses that will fight the verses of the Quran
mm-hmm.
and rebuked the, and therefore criticized the prophet. Therefore, the prophet would sit down and say that, yeah, they brought the verses. I can't bring it. They won. But they didn't do that. No, they had to lose their lives in war. So at the end of the day, that brings up the fact that they were unable to, them being unable to and going into war, still fighting Islam. This is pretty much the point of the miracle of the Prophet.
I think the new generation of the scholars who studied the Quran are not concerned with the with it being a revelation or not. But, no, I mean the Muslims, the believing ones, they believe that it was a revelation, but they are mostly talking about this mechanism of the revelation. How it was revealed to Prophet Muhammad, okay? This is the howness of the revelation. Okay?
Nice, very nice.
Not
yes,
the whatness
yes.
of the revelation.
Yeah, there's this thing that I wanted to say just before I give the answer to your question. That it's believed that why are scholars, Islamic scholars, considered holy? It's because they learn the sayings of the companions. This is a Sunni saying. They learn the sayings of the companions, and the companions learn the sayings of the Prophet, and the Prophet takes his knowledge from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is holy, therefore our knowledge is holy. We have this knowledge, so therefore we're considered holy.
Okay.
That's one thing. It's mm-hmm. it's something that, you know, we have this, it's in the back of our minds. Yes. It's something that it's what we call in mutasalam alay, something accepted, and
yes.
therefore we don't study it.
Something absolute and accepted.
Absolute. Okay. Sheikh Mahdi Ma'rifat, a great Quranic science teacher.
At-Tamheed.
Yeah, At-Tamheed, eight volumes.
Yes.
There's also Mukhtasar At-Tamheed,
yes,
and
yes,
then Mukhtasar, Mukhtasar At-Tamheed.
Okay.
Yeah, and very beautifully put this topic forward, and how the howness of the revelation. How does a human body with a human innate connect to something unhuman and gain the knowledge from the unseen? And it's put forward that the spirit and the, you know, the cleanness of the spirit and the mental capacity of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi and whatnot and whatnot. But at the end of the day, I want to ask this question. Does it change anything?
It does.
How?
In a way, of course.
This is a serious question. I'm not questioning for argument's sake.
No, this is not my opinion. At least it will cut out some of the... some of the so-called, this is not my opinion, but in their opinions, imaginary stories about a Gabriel or an angel coming down, giving the verses to the Prophet Muhammad, or the other, for example, hallucinatory dreams or illusions that were around Prophet Muhammad, okay? At least it will give a realistic, it's better to say, interpretation out of the mechanism of wahy, isn't it?
Yeah, the thing is that it's either one of two. Either the devils, right?
Okay.
It's either the devils or his craze, or it's the angels.
Okay.
When you look at the meanings put in the words of the Holy Quran, do these meanings come from the devil? That's my question.
Of course not.
Thank you very much. Okay. Does these highly sophisticated words and meanings come from person and craze?
But according to this Egyptian scholar, Nasr Hamad Abu Zayd, who says that there is still a relation between this meaning of the wahy with what was before the religion of Islam, as a wahy, a kind of connection with the worlds of the jinns, okay? The meaning of the wahy, okay, over there. And when Prophet Muhammad said that this Quran is a wahy to me, the Arabs on that time understood it was as if the wahy was defined in terms of...
How did the
connection.
Arabs understand that when they would call him crazy and they would say that it was a shaitan, it was the devil that's giving them the
revelation? No, this is not the
that's
devil.
Contradictory to
no,
the
this is not devil, but the word of the jinns, a world unknown or secretive to the Arabs, isn't it?
Well, the Arabs at that time didn't understand this meaning, which he's saying after 1,000...
They understood.
No, they understood.
How did they understand the meaning when the verses are saying that...
I mean the meaning which he has brought after 1,400 years after the revelation,
exactly, yeah.
The Arabs at that time didn't understand this meaning, which he can understand
now. Do
you
know why? Because
obviously we need to refer to the history to this part, and this is not acceptable.
So there are so many examples of the poets and the poetic devices over there. I mean, the Arabs who used to be famous through their poetries, okay? And when they asked them, where do these, for example, the verses of your poets come from? It is because of our relation to the worlds of the jinns, and not, for example, a supernatural being or the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, okay?
I personally haven't read the words of this Egyptian scholar, but I will
he
will return them.
He is among those scholars, Nas Hamad Abu Zayd, you know,
I'll read it, no problem. Okay. I'll return to it. But for now, what I have in my mind right now is that we have to understand the meaning of the miracle of the Quran. There are a couple of theories out there of what is the meaning of the Quran being a miracle. There's the theory of Sayyid al-Murtada, as-Sarf, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala took away the free will from people to have the chance to bring in, you know, new verses that are in front of the Quran.
That's right.
There's also the theory of the scientific facts and the pure judgments that the Quran has, which is also accepted nowadays, and it's highly accepted as well. And the main one, which is the eloquence of the Holy Quran. And I think when you have to go back and understand the meaning of the eloquence of the Quran, what is the meaning of eloquence? Is it bringing beautiful words without the correct meaning?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's the way that you bring the words for the people that you're talking to in a precise way, in a precise meaning, with high meanings.
Yes.
Al-balagha mutabaqat al-kalam li-muqtada al-hal.
Yes.
I don't know the correct Arabic translation for it, but that's the meaning of balagha, or eloquence, which is pretty much, you know, trying to explain it, is that you bring in these words, words that have the correct meaning, suitable for the people that you're talking to, with the highest, you know, the highest mentality possible for the suitable audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the best way to put it out there.
Okay.
And at the end of the day, this person is stating that this wahi, the reality of the Prophet is something that the devils brought forward. If the devils brought forward, the devils of those are also able to bring it forward as well. So why is the contradiction?
We got different interpretations, you know. It's very unfortunate to say that most of them are Iranians nowadays, you know, in the world. Like Surush, like Mujtahid Shabastari, and the other guys, you know, Muhammad Argun, okay, also Nas Hamad Abu Zaid, and the other guys, you know, who try to give, a fact-based, realistic interpretation or picture out of the system of the revelation. One of them call it in a dreamlike form or imagination.
I have a question for them.
Okay,
how are you reaching to this point? What are your bases of knowledge in this? That's my question. How did you know that this is the way? Are you doing qiyas? Are you pretty much, you know, looking at similar things? You're analogizing things. Analogy does not bring certainty. Yes. It does not bring knowledge.
Okay.
It brings you assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And your assumptions are not correct. Are not always correct. They could be wrong.
That's all right. Okay, Sayyid.
Well, the point is these people who are talking about these things, how they're experiencing. Have they experienced this by themselves that they're explaining? Or as brother has said, like, on which basis are they talking? The problem for people today is they try to understand things through sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And science says that if you can sense these things through your senses, and anything which can be obviously known by the senses or the experiments, that is something acceptable for them.
Yes.
Whereas we have something which is beyond all these things. And even about the wahi, we have different meanings in the Quran. For example, the wahi on the mother of Musa.
Yes.
It was an inspiration.
Yes.
The wahi, which is on the
something
prophet,
that brought into her heart.
Yeah.
Okay. She followed it.
Yes. So, and the wahi, in the sense of Quran, has its own meanings. Now, the beauty of the Quran is that when we talk about the Quran is not just the book of Allah, but obviously it is a miracle. And on top of that, when it is a miracle, it has a tahaddi. Tahaddi means it's challenging people. That you should bring it. Now it's 1,400 years from the time Quran was revealed. No one could bring even a single verse.
Oh, they got the answer to this question. It is like the other works that were produced by the other peoples around the world who has not the like.
Why?
For example, the words of the poetry or an author or a writer or, I don't know, for example, William Shakespeare.
We have a better work. There are people who have brought better things than what they have. And Quran is challenging to bring even one verse.
I know, brother, but this
one verse means, you know, when you look at the Shakespeare work, you look at the whole work as well.
Okay.
You don't look at just one point or one phrase or one verse of the point. Whereas Quran says just bring even a single verse. You know, this much of challenge that has been brought in the Quran, you cannot see. Whereas you can see the similar works done by other things, which are done by the other humans, even a small part of it.
I think, Sayyid, that there's a problem with them understanding the meaning of eloquence. When you study balagha, you understand. Well, now I can't say the terms on the radio, right? For example, the saja, or for example mm-hmm. the qafiyah, which is pretty much the last words,
yes.
Or for example the using the words of huruf al halaq at the mm-hmm. precise time, using the words the letters that come out of, for example, the throat.
Wasn't it the way that the Arabs used to talk on that time? I mean, the normal speaking.
That's
way?
The thing. That's the thing. Like how Jesus Christ. People at that time, medicine was booming at that time, right?
Yes.
Medicine was booming at that time. Jesus Christ came and made miracles of medicine. He brought people back to life. He made the blind see back with eyesight again,
okay.
Right? He had this miracle. He had this power. It was the same thing. People were doing medical things. He was doing his medical thing as well. This medical thing was God-given. That medical thing was human. Was a humankind thing.
Uh-huh.
So at the end of the day, Arabs were talking Arabic. Okay. They had this power.
Yes.
That is why they used to, you know, the person that was a poet that time,
yes,
was not only respected. You know how we respect people with knowledge nowadays? You know how we respect the people with high prestige?
Yes.
People with poetry power who were poets were considered highly respected people. And they were people that were loved and cherished.
Yes.
And they were so much. They would come and, you know, they would battle with these poems. And they would sit down and just talk about poems. It was all their talk.
Okay.
Their eloquence was all their talk.
Mm-hmm.
When these verses came, they're not going to come to Habib, who was an American, who barely could speak Arabic and English. And, you know, well, I don't know why Arabi is bringing him to the radio show. But anyway. But it's not going to challenge me. It's going to challenge the true Arabs, the people that truly know the meaning of the poems, truly know how to put poems forward. And that is why there are a lot of stories. Whenever the challenges would come, even bring one verse that's like the Quran, okay, people say, they would say that we can't.
Mm-hmm.
They would say that we can't. Enemies. We're not talking about friends. We're talking about enemies. Enemies, people who are going to fight the Prophet, who are fighting the Prophet, they say we can't bring it forward. Isn't that enough for you to just accept that the fact that it's highly eloquent, the Arabs at the time accepted it?
Thank you very much, Brother Habib.
You're welcome.
And Sayyid Mohsen for a presence in the program. Viewpoints talking about the Holy Quran as the words of Allah or Prophet Muhammad. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this episode and the other episodes of the program Viewpoints, visit our website at parstudio.com / Call of Islam page, also YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi Aman Allah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies, as I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Following its imperial playbook, the U.S. sanctions imposed on Afghanistan are aimed at destabilizing Afghan civil society, making daily life so unbearable that the Afghan people eventually blame the Taliban for their misery, providing the United States and its proxies an opening to enact regime change, says Zachary Scott Ryder in an article published under the heading, Biden Lies Again, as he covertly continues the U.S. forever war against the Afghan people. Stay tuned for more. Over the past few months, U.S. lawmakers, the Afghan government, and the international community have called on Washington to stop strangling the Afghan economy as its people continue to suffer from a U.S.-created humanitarian crisis. On December 22nd, the Biden administration effectively rejected those calls, opting instead for half measures that will do little to counter the effects of stringent economic sanctions imposed on the Taliban or to improve the material well-being of the Afghan people. Contrary to the narrative of U.S. politicians and journalists, the August 2021 withdrawal of U.S. and NATO forces from Afghanistan did not mark the end of the United States' forever war, but rather a shift in U.S. policy from direct military intervention and occupation to one based on economic sanctions and indirect political subversion. Although the tactics changed, the goal is the same: the accumulation of wealth and power through class warfare against the Afghan people. Just days after Kabul fell to the Taliban on August 15th, Washington took measures to turn off the flow of funds to the new government and paralyze the Afghan banking system. The Treasury Department quickly issued a freeze order on nearly $9.5 billion of the Afghan central bank's assets held in U.S. financial institutions, including the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Although the Taliban was entitled to receive more than $460 million from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, in currency reserves known as Special Drawing Rights, or SDRs, the U.S. directed the IMF to block those funds as well. President Biden has also ensured that $1.3 billion of Afghan funds held in international accounts remain frozen, including funds denominated in euros and British pounds and those held by the Swiss-based Bank for International Sanctions. Despite purported exemptions for humanitarian aid, the lack of clarity under U.S. law deters financial institutions from processing such transactions out of fear of violating U.S. sanctions, which not only freeze all assets associated with the Taliban, they subject any individual or entity that conducts a transaction involving the Taliban to criminal liability. The ubiquity of U.S. dollars and financial institutions in international commerce provides the U.S. with virtually global jurisdiction. Decades of U.S. occupation and war have left Afghanistan a poor country dependent on external sources to fund public spending. No longer able to rely on brute military and political force to protect the interests of Western capital in Afghanistan, U.S. strategists understand that seizing the central bank's money and cutting all international aid gives Washington powerful leverage against the Taliban, all while inflicting maximum pain on the Afghan people, who continue to be relegated to starving pawns in big power games. The horrific and totally foreseeable consequences of these sanctions have so far been well documented by international humanitarian organizations, even if they are reluctant to depict the United States as culpable. On October 25th, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and World Food Program published a report urging humanitarian assistance, warning that Afghanistan is on a countdown to catastrophe. According to the report, more than 50% of the Afghans will face crisis or emergency levels of acute food insecurity, including over 3 million children under the age of 5. On November 22nd, the United Nations Development Program published a report warning that Afghanistan's financial and bank payment systems are in disarray and on the verge of collapse. The UNDP report, citing the IMF, predicts the Afghan economy could contract by 30% for 2021 to 2022. On December 6th, the International Crisis Group issued a more scathing report warning that the hunger and destitution caused by economic strangulation imposed by the West in response to the Taliban takeover could kill more Afghans than all the bombs and bullets of the past two decades. In other words, U.S. policy of intentionally starving the Afghan people through economic sanctions on Afghanistan is going as planned. As many predicted, blocking funds from Taliban and curtailing foreign aid and assistance would lead to a rapid financial meltdown and exacerbate the ongoing famine plaguing Afghanistan. Despite the Taliban's success in forcing the U.S. government to negotiating table in Doha and then ousting the U.S. military from Afghanistan, or rather, because of that success, Washington has made it clear that it has no plans to respect Afghanistan's sovereignty. Indeed, the Biden administration's response to pleas that the asset freeze be lifted demonstrates the hypocrisy and callousness of U.S. foreign policy. The U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, Thomas West, remarks, effectively admitted that the dire situation predates the Taliban takeover and confirmed that the United States was preventing critical international aid from reaching Afghanistan as retribution for the Taliban's military success, while recognizing that Afghanistan's economy is enormously dependent on aid, including for basic services. In tacit acknowledgement that the state needs legitimacy to stabilize its rule, the U.S.-driven humanitarian crisis has prompted members of Congress to ask the Biden administration to to reconsider certain aspects of its sanctions policy in light of the dire warnings issued by the UNDP and World Food Program. On December 15th, a bipartisan group of 39 lawmakers wrote a letter to the State and Treasury Departments calling on the Biden administration to allow international financial institutions to inject the necessary economic capital into Afghanistan while avoiding the transfer of money to the Taliban-led government and designated private Afghan or third country bank as a central bank. The lawmakers also recommended, among other things, the release of the $9.5 billion of Afghan assets, but only if sent to an appropriate United Nations agency and only if used to pay teacher salaries and provide meals to children in schools, so long as girls can continue to attend. On December 20th, a group of 46 lawmakers led by the House Progressives wrote a letter to Biden, explicitly linking the U.S. confiscation of $9.4 billion of Afghan assets to contributing to soaring inflation and plunging the country deeper into economic and humanitarian crisis. Although the House Progressives struck a harsher tone, they made the same request as the December 19th letter, urging Biden to allow Afghanistan's central bank to access its reserves, consistent with proposals by current and former Afghan central bank officials appointed by the U.S.-supported government and supported by private sector associations such as the Afghan Chamber of Commerce and Investment and the Afghanistan Banks Association. This congressional pushback, tepid as it is, also reflects an inherent tension in the U.S. use of sanctions. While economic warfare is a necessary tool of U.S. foreign policy, sanctions are not always good for business in the short term. Afghanistan had been a source of wealth for the imperialist bourgeois for the past two decades, and now certain sectors of the capitalist class apparently want back in. Still, the Biden administration has shown no sign of easing the sanctions. In fact, the Biden administration is considering permanently depriving the Afghan people of the funds needed to combat the current humanitarian crisis by transferring those funds instead to U.S. plaintiffs with outstanding default judgments against the Taliban. Although his formal statement is not due until January 18, 2022, the Biden administration seems willing to go along with the plan. The only apparent obstacle is how to seize the Afghan funds without recognizing the Taliban as the legitimate Afghan government. Press Secretary Jen Psaki has twice cited that ongoing litigation as the primary reason for maintaining the asset freeze. Following its imperial playbook, the U.S. sanctions imposed on Afghanistan are aimed at destabilizing Afghan civil society, making daily life so unbearable that the Afghan people eventually blame the Taliban for their misery, providing the United States and its proxies an opening to enact regime change.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.